At area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Speaking of worldwide, my guest is the worldwide expert, the world's expert, on NDEs, life after death. Whatever it is that happens as we approach the door of death. We'll be right back. The story you're about to hear is just astounding. I mean, try and imagine an aneurysm in the brain. That's like, I don't know, it's like a blood vessel that in one part has sort of weakened and turned into a balloon, getting thinner and thinner as it expands. And of course, when it explodes, which is what an aneurysm can do, well, then you're dead. The brain floods with blood, I guess, and you're dead. Well, Pam had an aneurysm, an inoperable aneurysm. Doctor?
And so, the family found a surgeon in Phoenix who did a radically new procedure. They took Pam out to Phoenix, and she was put on a rotating operating table, and her body was progressively cooled until she became extremely hypothermic, very low body temperature, and then they stopped her heart. They took the top of her head off and then rotated the table so that she was upside down, and they drained all the blood from her body.
All the blood out of her body.
That's
so
right.
So obviously then everything's shut down. Brainwave flat.
That's right.
Isn't that right?
That's right.
And no heart pumping, no blood in the body, all the blood out of the body. This person is...
Yes, by the criteria that I learned in medical school, certainly. She was
dead. Very dead.
Yep. And so then, of course, since there's no pressure in the arteries anymore, then they could go in and they could take that aneurysm and repair it. And then once they did that...
Without the blood, it would deflate like a balloon.
That's right.
And so then there it is, just deflated, and I guess they can clip it out, sew it up.
That's right. No more danger of hemorrhage. So that's what they did.
How long did that take?
You know, I don't remember.
Well, I do. About 40 minutes total.
About 40 minutes.
So this woman was dead, in effect, clinically, in every way you could measure, for 40 minutes.
Yeah, you know, I talked with her husband about this in Winston-Salem, and he was marveling about it. And I said, well, you know, that means that by the criteria you and I learned, she was dead. And he said, yep, dead as a doornail. And so then they sewed the top of her head back on, put her body back horizontally, began to reinfuse the blood into her body, gradually warming her up, When her body got to a certain temperature, they restarted her heart, and she came back to life and is vibrantly alive. And with this incredible story of passing out of her body, relating conversations that went on during the surgery, she told Michael Sabom, my friend in Atlanta, who interviewed her about this, that she was describing how certain tools they used in the surgery looked, and she described one as looking like a an electric toothbrush. And you know, cardiologists are not heart surgeons, so Michael, being a cardiologist, listened to this, and to him it didn't ring true. He just didn't believe the part about the electric toothbrush. But anyway, he got in touch with the with the heart surgeon in Phoenix, who sent him a photograph back of the instrumentation used, and there was that instrument that looked like the electric toothbrush. And so Pam describes this voyage out of her body, went into this other realm, was escorted back down through this tunnel or passageway by an uncle, as I recall, and then came back into her body and is fully alive. I saw an interview with the surgeon who did this procedure, and he obviously was just quite incomprehending and startled by what she said, and as the interview made it appear, certainly, just couldn't comprehend how this could be. As I myself can't comprehend how it could be.
I can't comprehend any of it. I can't grasp any of it. Where was she for 40 minutes? Where was Pam?
That's right. Yeah, or, you know, it just really doesn't stack up. I mean, I've heard other things. There are just so many.
I'll tell you what. Let me hold you there for a second. I've got kind of a special personal line. Somebody, Tom, a doctor, sent me a quick computer message, and I'm very, very tempted to bring him on with you for just a second. Tom, are you there? Tom is a physician, right, Tom?
I'm an emergency physician in Washington State.
An emergency physician in Washington State. For how long, Tom?
23 years.
23 years. And you have something you want to say?
I'm a board-certified emergency physician, and I've been doing this for a very long time and have attended the deaths of an awful lot of people. And I can't believe that the story that your guest just told sort of meshes in with the story that happened to me. I was in the emergency department late one evening when a woman had a cardiac arrest at a restaurant, and she had completely collapsed, was unresponsive, and they called the ambulance. The ambulance drove down about six or eight blocks, caught an elevator up, the service elevator, up to where she was at, and when they found her, she was completely unresponsive and in ventricular fibrillation. There's no blood flow to her brain at all. And when they arrived at the scene, they put a breathing tube in her and gave her some electric shocks, and her heart started breathing. And it was about 5 minutes. It was at the very, very the very, very longest that people who suffer this kind of event come back with any kind of meaningful intellectual activity.
Right.
I mean, she was way out there. When she arrived in the emergency department about 15 minutes later, she was, for all practical purposes, next to brain dead. If you imagine your house with all the lights on as a normal person, there was one bathroom light on. I mean, it was that little tiny thing that you plug into the electric switch. That was all that was left. She had a gag reflex if you pulled on the endotracheal tube, and there was no other response in her. She was admitted to the intensive care unit and cared for and eventually discharged from the hospital. And I sort of lost follow-up on this lady. About a year later, I was in the emergency department. There was this perky red lady complaining of some chest problems on the stretcher, and I walked in and introduced myself. We had a little chat, and then I went back and looked at her old records, And there was this record of this lady who had had this horrible cardiac arrest and was next to brain dead when I admitted her to the hospital. And I said, my God, how did things go after your cardiac arrest?
Mm-hmm.
And she said, well, they couldn't get me through the kitchen.
They couldn't get me through the kitchen.
They couldn't get me through the kitchen. And I go, what? And says, all I remember about my cardiac arrest was is they couldn't get me through the kitchen. And as there are things that happen, there's serendipitous events, and at the very same time that this lady was in the emergency department on her second visit, the medic who had resuscitated her in that restaurant was in my lounge eating dinner. And I asked him to come over and explain this situation. He said, oh, my God, we could not get in. He didn't hear me talk with her.
Right.
This is a completely unrelated event. I said, Wayne, what happened to this lady at this arrest at the restaurant a year ago? And he goes, oh, we couldn't get her through the kitchen. The hallways in the kitchen, through the winding corridors, through those tables, you couldn't get the stretcher through the kitchen. And
no.
They jammed their stretcher in the kitchen. They couldn't get her out through the kitchen.
No way she could have known that.
But no way she could have known it. And here these two independent people corroborate this story that they couldn't get her through the kitchen.
Well, there you go.
So
thank you, doctor. Thank you very much. There is one, Dr. Moody, from another physician. There's no way. I mean, somebody whose heart has stopped.
Well, you know, I remain baffled by this. You know, I've had all kinds of experiences in my medical practice, certainly not as much experience with resuscitations as I'm sure Tom has had, although a lot of that, even with the resuscitations, but primarily... most of the people I've taken care of were terminally ill people that we didn't resuscitate. And even in situations like that, some astonishing things happened. There, one event occurred years ago now that I just still scratch my head and just marvel. Basically, this is still a very personal story that I... can't divulge everything about it, but let's put it this way. I was dealing with a terminal patient and was seeing him in his house and didn't know this man that well. I knew some of the family members, but I didn't know this man that well. He certainly didn't know any personal details about my life. And on this one day that I was going to see him, I had this gosh-awful, entirely personal, and this is the part I can't relate, but it just, something that I was working on then, it was totally unrelated to this case of this man. But it was just a problem that was just gosh-awful and unique to me. This was a very unique kind of situation and a problem that had come up in my personal life, not in my professional life.
Yes.
And I was just worried to death, worried sick about this all day. Well, that evening, I went over to this person's house, and when I walked in the door, his daughter came up and she said, we just can't figure it out. She said, all day he's been going on and on about, and then she said, my exact problem that was bugging me that day. Now, you know, I mean, I'm sure many, many other physicians could share similar things with you. And there's not really any way, I think, within the current logic that we use of computing this or figuring these things out. But certainly when they happen to you, they're quite, they are life-changing.
Oh, yes.
This happened well over 10 years ago now, this thing I'm talking about, and I still think about it almost every day. Just absolutely bewildering to me.
Doctor, do you think there is any difference in the number of NDEs that occur to people who are anticipating death versus those who get into some sort of flash accident? And I'm asking this for, I hope, an obvious reason. If you're anticipating death in our modern day, we've had so much on the air in the media about NDEs that one might imagine a person would have an expectation built up, or even certainly be thinking very hard about the possibility of an afterlife as they near their death. They know it's coming. They know they've got a fatal disease or whatever, versus somebody who, kaboom, gets into an accident, didn't see it coming, didn't even give it a moment's thought, and there it is.
Art, I don't know, but I will say one thing about it, about that, is that, you know, back in the 60s and early 70s when I was interviewing people, I had a sort of clear field, as it was, because there wasn't really any publicity till the mid-70s.
Right.
So I had a long period of time when I had people who had never heard of this. And in 2005, when this has been so publicized, I think you and I, being people who follow the media, I mean, you're talking to a 2 or 3 hour CNN, at 2 or 3 hour a day CNN man here.
Yes.
You know,
me too.
So we follow the news and we see what's going on, and so we naturally assume that that people more, you know, are like us. But what I have learned in my practice really is that that doesn't seem to be a very accurate assumption.
Okay.
Not too long ago, I worked with some cardiologists who had a practice of, and because of their cardiology practice, basically it was mostly, you know, sort of well-off middle-aged men, business people, who in their practice, who, you know, had the typical midlife or, you know, 70 and into their 70s heart attack, and had spent their whole life sort of preoccupied with their business and the workaday world and so on, and suddenly would have this cardiac arrest and then have these experiences. Well,
mm-hmm.
They had, one of their patients had a dramatic experience like this, which brought it to the attention of these cardiologists. So I was living not too far away from where their practice was, so they would call me when they got interested in this, and they would call me occasionally when they had patients who had this sort of experience. And I was just fascinated that these people who were quite well off, and you would think to be very informed, certainly very intelligent and accomplished people, didn't have a clue about this. I mean, yeah, they would just be flabbergasted after I would do my interview and so on, and they would say, well, doctor, have you ever heard anything like this before? And I would assure them that, yes, I mean, this is quite, you know, this is exactly the kind of story I've heard from thousands of people. And even though at that time there had been abundant publicity about it, these people just hadn't heard of it. So I think that you and I, because of our habits, probably tend to think, sort of to overestimate the degree of awareness that people have of this.
Well, perhaps so. But in this modern day, as people approach death, surely the thoughts of whether it's really all over or whether something else...
Oh, that part, yes. I mean, and that goes back to antiquity. You know, I remember in the very first few pages or so of Plato's Republic, there's this same story that certainly as people age, when they get into their 60s and so on, and they can, they begin to think, uh-oh, you know, my
well,
dad,
yeah.
That they, it really does, then they really start thinking about this in a very deep way.
Of course, more is gone than is to go. I mean,
that's right.
That's clear. So, do you have any advice for those of us who are now getting on in age and have to begin thinking about things like this?
Well, one thing I want to say is a sad thing is that it's kind of like when it's the 11th hour and it's a race against time. Well, that's not the the ideal circumstance for logical thinking.
No.
Plus, and especially as we both know in that sort of circumstance, people get very vulnerable to charlatans. I mean, you and I both know that there are plenty of people around who will give people the answers, right?
I mean, sure.
And you're like, oh, well, you know, I want to know whether there's a life after death. Well, sure, buddy, I've got the answers for you here. And of course, that's a very hazardous situation. Actually, Art, something that I have been working on, actually, it's my oldest continuous work. It goes back to 1963 was when I started working on it. I have been working out a whole new kind of logic. And I do think, actually, that it's possible for people, and especially maybe people who are of older age, because, you know, when I went to college back in 62...
I'm sorry, it's possible for them to what?
To really get closer to the truth about this. You know, I've been telling you for years, I think that when somebody says, oh, I've got scientific evidence of life after death, that's bogus. But I do think that we're on the verge of having a whole new way of thinking about this that actually will make it possible to think out this and to come to get closer to the truth.
Maybe one day a scientific explanation will be possible. Dr. Raymond Moody is my guest. I wonder what that would do to the world, don't you, if science said, we've got it, we've got the proof, there is life after death. What would that do to the world?
Talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Boy, I'll tell you, if a woman can be dead in every clinical manner for 40 minutes and then come back with a big story, if people can tell us about not being able to get through a kitchen door when their heart was stopped, no blood was moving, well, all of these things mean we don't know a lot about the brain. We certainly don't know much about the process of death itself. In fact, that alone is pretty scary. What if when we die, we don't intellectually die right away? What if we are aware of things around us for quite a while after they've zipped up the bag? That's something to think about. If patients know what's going on while their heart stopped and while the blood's not moving, the brain's not being nourished, then that means we just don't understand all that much about death and the process of death and what really is death. I mean, we define it in a certain way, but what if we're wrong, Doctor?
Well, you know, I think we probably are wrong. I mean, you know, by definition, the big mysteries of existence are big mysteries, and you know, to me, it just seems rather foolhardy for anybody to think that that they would have a clear notion about that. I mean, let's hypothesize that there is some kind of life after death, then at the very minimum, we can sort of imagine that it's a transformation of some kind that's far more dramatic than we have ever experienced.
Yes.
While we're alive. Even just unimaginable. So, in a way, all bets are off. I mean, even the people who've come very close to death, about the most common thing they tell us is that they just don't have any words to describe what they went through. And they also say that time and space, as you and I appreciate it, evaporate at that point, so that they find themselves in a timeless, spaceless existence that they can't even describe.
I'm curious. After all the work, years of work that and research that you put into this area, have you come to the point, honestly, that you can tell me that you're very comfortable that when you die, there is an existence that goes beyond that physical death? Are you certain of that now, Doctor, in the way a religious person is comforted?
I am absolutely not. Now,
no.
I will say this, that number one, I think there's three ways that people have to settle this question for themselves, which is the biggest question of all,
of
is
course.
There life after death?
You bet.
Some people say that they have faith that determines it for them. I respect those people, but I'm not in that category. Other people have had some experience, like a near-death experience, that settles it for them, and I respect that group, but I'm not in that category. The only path left to me is reason. And the fact is that it's just to be, I think that if people resort to reason about the about the question of life after death,
yes,
they really need to acknowledge to themselves what that's all about is that they are looking for the unique legitimacy that reason provides. Because, you know, I mean, nobody balances their checkbook by consulting the astrology column, right? But the reason you use arithmetic is that, you know, as long as you follow the rules, you're going to get the same answer that the bank does or that the computer does or whatever. And that's the point of reason, that it gives us a legitimate answer, but the legitimacy comes from following the rules. So often, in this case of looking into the question of life after death, people want to say, oh, yes, you know, I'm being scientific about it or whatever, but really all they're trying to do is to make the outcome positive. And so then they fudge. And so that makes it's like they're deceiving themselves. I mean, I honestly don't know, but I think this, and I think there's hope. And the hope that I think there is that I do think that there's a way to bridge. The logic that we use is not adequate to the question, but I think that there is a way of bridging and extending logic into a new realm that will get us closer to the answer. That much I'm convinced of. But this is the trick with that, and that is that most of the people who are interested in, they think that they're interested in the question of life after death, what it really boils down to is that they want to hear inspiring stories. Mm. And you love stories. I love stories. And you know, I've heard thousands of these things, and I hope I hear thousands more. I love stories.
Of course I love stories.
But the fact is, the stories will never
be enough.
No amount of stories will ever get us to that point of certainty about life after death. And so that's the real question, that I think that improvement can occur. We can get a lot closer to the answer, but that it's going to take conceptual reasoning rather than just this
All right. Well, science is pushing forward very, very quickly. One of the things I said at the bottom of the last hour was, you know, how would it affect the world? If science suddenly came to some sort of absolute conclusive answer, who knows what it might be, but in some way did determine that there is life after death, did something or had a communication with the dead or something that was irrefutable that proved to the world that indeed there is an existence following the physical one, what that would do to the world?
Well, you know, maybe one of the reasons that we don't know is that if we can imagine that situation, that maybe it would dissolve the barrier between the worlds. I mean, suppose that we did have some sort of system of reason that could give us a sure answer.
Yes.
Then maybe that would dissolve the very distinction. I mean, it would be kind of embarrassing to sit around and go through your daily activities with the certain knowledge in your head that there's another dimension. You know, I mean, then it would be aware that our current existence is dreamlike, which it is anyway.
So, I mean, is it necessary for the world to function to not be able to answer that question?
You know, I've often puzzled about that very thing. It may be that there's something deep within us that people really don't want to know whether there's life after death, because if they realize that if they did know, then it would make this whole existence we're in kind of illusory.
Yeah. You've got a kind of an interesting segment in the questions lined up to ask you, and that is, I guess you did work with criminally insane people, and you've got something on serial killers and mass murderers. What do you know about them? How do they fit into this?
Well, I did. I worked for a while in a maximum security unit art for the criminally insane, dealing with paranoid schizophrenic killers and mass murderers and occasional serial killers.
Yes.
The schizophrenics and so on, I mean, you could kind of understand that because it's as though they're in a dream. I mean, I think it was Jung who said the schizophrenic is a dreamer awake. Huh. And you know, to them, they weren't killing an innocent person. They were killing the communist, you know, who was chasing them or whatever in their minds. But the serial killers, that was very tough because, you know, most of them are sociopaths, and you can't really tell what's going on with them because they will just try to figure out what they think you want to hear, and then they'll feed it back to you.
Really?
So you can never get a sense of a real person operating, with a sociopath. And so for that very reason, I mean, they're very enigmatic. I could never figure out what was going on, if anything, inside a sociopath.
So in other words, they're serial killers are a blank to you.
Yeah. I mean, you can get certain kinds of things, obviously, about them. I mean, obviously, they get a sexual thrill from the killing, because, you know, they often have an orgasm at the point they kill the person and that sort of thing. So to them, the act of killing is sexualized. but there's no real honesty to them. I mean, as I say, they just try to read you and then to manipulate you to feed back to you what they sense that you want to hear so that you don't have a sense of a real person. It's interesting that in all those years, I never really met in that environment. I mean, serial killers, you just don't know what to make of them. But of the paranoid schizophrenic killers and that sort of thing and the mass murderers, I never met up with anybody in that circumstance that I felt was evil, per se. I mean, most of these things, we all understand, for example, what resentment is. And a lot of these guys, the mass murderers, it was just that resentments had built up to such a degree that one day they just sort of exploded. And, you know, I guess we've all exploded and we've all had resentments, so we can all kind of imagine what that would be like. Evil is not something I even encountered in a in a forensic psychiatry situation.
That's
although
fascinating.
Certainly in other aspects of life, you see it going on.
But in the cell blocks where mass murderers are locked up, serial killers, those kinds of people, you find them very hard to read. In other words, they're just trying to tell you what you want to hear, but not really explain what they feel.
That's right. That's how it is, not just with serial killers, but sociopaths in general. First of all, they are all very talkative, usually, and they're very charming. That's why a serial killer can get to their victims, because they're so charming that they can get the person right in the car with them and so on. And people think they're very nice people and so on often.
Well, I guess that's why a program like mine does so well, dealing in the paranormal, dealing in all these kinds of things. These are things people want to know about. They really do. Certainly, the people in this audience, for the most part, really are curious about this type of thing. And that leads us into investigations of the paranormal generally and things that cannot be explained. Oh, by the way, I've been asking a lot of guests lately. I found this wonderful show on TV called Medium. Have you seen it yet?
I haven't. No, I haven't.
Nobody's seen it. Everybody
I
has.
Haven't.
All right, well,
really
it's one you've got to catch. It's called Medium, and it's extremely well done. Mm-hmm. What is your view of mediums in general?
Well, now, first of all, I've known a number of people in my life, ladies in the neighborhood. You know, I mean, the kind of people who live down the street and who have this kind of uncanny, incomprehensible talent of being able to tell you things. And as long as it's in the neighborhood and that kind of, and these are very unobtrusive people who just a few people know about the talent and so on. That's
yes.
One thing. That is genuinely baffling to me, Art. I've seen things, people like that do things that I just can't imagine what's happening.
I've seen it too. And I had very occasionally I had an experience or so with things that are just completely inexplicable.
Yep.
And so they do exist.
Yep, that's right. And then on the other hand, there are the performers. I mean, you and I both know you can go down to the magic shop.
Oh, yes.
And you can buy a book that can tell you how to do this and make people absolutely convinced that you have supernatural powers. And that part, I mean, I think that one thing I always tell people, and the practical way it comes up with me is this. I do a lot of grief counseling. And so from time to time I have people come to me and they say, well, should I go to a medium? And I say, I mean, you know, and that is, then people are putting themselves into your hands. I mean, you have to make a real, real thoughtful judgment. And this is what I tell people. I say, well, if you're going to do it, then you sort of owe it to yourself to read up on how some of these things can be produced by trickery.
Uh-huh.
So I always tell people, if you want to do it, arm yourself first with information about how it can be done fraudulently, because there are all sorts of ways. You know, one of the ways that's not very often talked about in the public domain, I've noticed, is that the fraudulent mediums work together, even though on the outside they may be kind of like the professional wrestling, acting as though they're bitter enemies and so on.
Yes.
They actually work together, and it's been known since antiquity. The people who worked in the Greek oracles knew that the average person who goes to an oracle is going to show up at another oracle within the next year or two.
But isn't it, from this point of view, Doctor, isn't it a legitimate occupation? In other words, a medium who perhaps may not be telling the truth or may be using some sort of trickery. In a way, they are grief counselors, aren't they?
Yes. I mean, it does. and even I think some of the ones who, and I just, first of all, one thing I learned in my forensic work is, You know, I mean, I can't make any judgments about anybody else's motivation. I mean, you know, I remember a judge asked me one time something about somebody's motivation, and I said, you know, Judge, I mean, here I am 40 years old. I can't even make a good judgment about my own motivation on most things. And, you know, he looked at me and he said, Dr. Moody, that's the wisest answer I've ever heard from an expert witness.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, I mean, I wouldn't want to make a judgment about anybody's motivation, but the fact is, these things can be done by trickery, and so it just naturally, people who consult mediums, I think, ought to really investigate this and become educated on it before trying it out.
All right, so you're not saying baloney.
No. I mean, I was saying I don't know. I mean, I've seen things that I don't understand, and I also know that some things can be done by trickery, so that the wise person ought to consult, really become educated before.
All right, how do you do that? Are there any books you recommend to people?
I think reading a wide array of books on it, books by people who've investigated mediums, books by mediums, magic books that give the simple step-by-step instructions on how to do it. You know, I had a really interesting experience about 10 years ago, or so, 8 or 10 years ago, down in Florida, Art. I was in a lecture, and I gave somebody from the audience asked a question about psychics.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave a similar sort of thing that I'm telling you about, that, you know, people ought to be careful because it can be done by trickery, but certainly we've all had experiences where we seem to know in some weird way what somebody else was thinking, and just being as I'm being now. Well, afterwards, they had a reception for me, and I was sitting in the reception, and this young woman, she was early 30s, as you could tell just by looking at her, and just from her whole demeanor, you could tell that she was a professional person from her vocabulary and the way
sure.
she presented herself, you know, like looked like a businesswoman.
Sure.
So she was really got on my case. She said, oh, you know, I went to the psychic, and he told me absolutely these things. There's no way he could have known it, and blah, 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 and so on. And so I said, well, now just a minute here. And I put my hands over my face, and I sort of, you know, leaned down, and I said, I just don't understand this. I just don't understand this, but I'm sitting in your office or in the place you work, and I'm pulling out your middle desk drawer. And I'm looking down here in the right-hand corner, and it looks to me like there's some little packages of McDonald's or Burger King mustard or ketchup or something like that. And that woman, I mean, Art, it was just like she bowed, like her head bobbed, and she sort of bowed. And I know from, as a psychiatrist,
you knew you had her.
Absolutely. That I could have said at that point, hop on my bus, we're joining my
and
cult.
She'd have been right
California.
There.
She would have been right there.
All right,
but
Dr. Moody.
I told her,
Dr. Moody,
yes.
Hold that. We'll be right back. From the high desert, Dr. Raymond Moody is my guest. How about you? A few little ketchups
nights
down there.
In white satin, never reaching the end. Letters I've written